This is Dr. Chad Edwards, and you are listening to podcast number 31 of Against the Grain. Are you tired and fatigued? Are you frustrated with doctors because they just don't seem to listen? Do you want to fix your pain without surgery? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then we are the clinic for you. We offer prolotherapy, PRP or platelet-rich plasma therapy, and stem cell injections, IV nutritional therapies, bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, and functional medicine to get you back on track to optimal health. Call our clinic at 918-935-3636 or visit our website at www.revolutionhealth.org to schedule your appointment today.
Welcome to Against the Grain podcast with Dr. Chad Edwards, where he challenges the status quo when it comes to medicine. We get into hot topics in the medical field with real stories from real patients to help you on your way to a healthy lifestyle. Get ready, because we're about to go against the grain.
Hello. This is the incredibly tall Marshall Morris here, and today I'm joined by Dr. Chad Edwards, who believes that 80% of the medical recommendations are crap, technically speaking here. He is the author of the book Revolutionize Your Health with Customized Supplements, and he served in the U.S. Army for 23 years as both an enlisted soldier and as an officer, as a physician. He graduated from medical school at Oklahoma State University, and he is the founder of RevolutionHealth.org. And this podcast, Against the Grain. Thanks so much, Dr. Chad Edwards.
Marshall Morris, you are a rock star.
I try not to mess up that introduction, because you do have quite the accolades here, but really your focus is this podcast and helping other people, reaching a broader group of people that are having the same symptoms and issues across the country.
Yep, that's exactly right. And one of the things, you know, obviously, we started this podcast because we wanted to let people know that there are other ways to approach things, and there's another method than just the traditional inside the box. Here's your problem. Here's your pill. Have a good day. So, you know, that's, we're trying to educate people across the board on all different kinds of things. And, you know, we talk about hormones and we talk about prolotherapy stuff and musculoskeletal pain. Today, this is a topic that I don't want to say I stumbled onto by accident, but I had patients that came to me that, you know, I certainly, some of these issues were not in my wheelhouse. I was not the expert in this stuff, but they came to me with these problems and conditions, and who was I going to send them to? You know, I didn't have somebody save for, you know, some, you know, well-known experts on the East Coast or, you know, something like that.
Sure.
So I had to do the best I could, and I had to do a bunch of research, and, you know, that doesn't make me the expert today. That's my disclaimer. But I've got some experience, as I've looked through the literature, you know, learned a lot about this stuff.
Okay, so let's get in today's hot topic.
Hot topic.
What are we talking about, Dr. Chad?
Today is Lyme disease.
Okay, so what, I mean, I know it's Lyme disease. In Oklahoma, I think it's ticks that carry Lyme disease. Is that right?
Yeah, well, across the board.
Okay.
The Borrelia burgdorferi is the name of the bacteria that traditionally has caused Lyme disease. Now, we've since identified a couple of other bacteria that can cause the disease-related symptoms. Now, interestingly, you mentioned, and this is a tick-borne illness, meaning you get bit by a tick that carries the Borrelia burgdorferi, there's a couple of different ticks that carry it. You get bit by a tick. There's different thoughts. Some people will say you have to have the tick on you for a number of hours before you can transmit it. I think there's a lot of controversy with this topic. Some people would say that chronic Lyme disease, which we'll talk a little bit about, doesn't really exist. That it's just, you know, like Rocky Mountain spotted fever. You get the bacteria. It causes you to be sick. You take antibiotics. It goes away. You're done. I have seen way too many patients that it just wasn't that simple. They got bit by a tick, whether they knew it or not. They had a rash, whether or not they had a rash, and now they've got a whole host of these symptoms. And, you know, we'll do some testing, and sometimes it's a slam dunk. Yep, this is no question Lyme disease. And sometimes we'll do the test. It's a little bit more gray, and I really want to delve a little bit deeper into the testing and where the criteria for this testing came from, because it really changes how you have to view Lyme disease and its diagnosis and how you follow it. That's really one of the big the big issues with this condition.
So what are a couple things that might indicate that I have Lyme disease? You know, how would I know?
Yeah, so I think it's important to start with the acute phase of Lyme disease. So first you have to be exposed. You have to have had a tick bite. Now, you don't have to know that you had a tick bite. We're not aware of any other method of transmission, you know, save for maybe like a blood transfusion or something like that. But we can't tell, and we don't think it's transmitted sexually. But there is a question about that in some people's minds. Syphilis is a spirochete. That's the kind of bacteria that Borrelia or Lyme disease is. And clearly syphilis is spread. You can communicate that sexually. So there's a question of, can you transmit this sexually? And I'm not aware of any confirmed cases, but there may be some out there. I just don't know. So some symptoms. You got to be exposed. It's also important to understand the adult tick, it's a certain size, and usually you can see it pretty well. But there's also these nymphs, these ticks, and they can transmit it as well. And they're like these seed ticks. And insects arthropods, these insects and spiders and ticks, they have different phases of their life, and they go through different stages. And nymph is one of them for a tick. And so they're these little bitty seed ticks, like the size, the head of a pin. You know, they're really, really small, and they may be very, very difficult to see, and they can transmit the bacteria. So you may never really even see a tick bite. One of the most classic symptoms associated with Lyme disease is a rash called erythema migrans, and that is a circular rash, and that is supposed to represent the bacteria spreading through the tissue or through the skin in a circular or almost a bullseye or targeted lesion around the tick bite. Now, today as we're recording these podcasts, I'm telling all my stories. Last summer, I was out with a buddy and I was kind of in my dress clothes, and he was like, "Hey, come out with me." Actually, it was Brian.
Okay.
And we were in his backyard, and he's got some woods behind him. He's like, "Come out with me. We're going to go collect some firewood." So I go out there in my dress shoes, and I'm collecting firewood with him. I'm wearing jeans. And I get back home, and the next day I have a tick on my inner leg, and pulled the tick off. And like 2 days later, a day later or something, I've got this rash. It's a little bit sore, red rash around that thing. And I called one of my physician buddies, and I was just like, I got this thing. I was bitten by a tick. I don't really know. And she, functional medicine doctor. In fact, her name is Dr. Betty Bischoff, and she is absolutely phenomenal. And her website, if you wanted to look her up, she's in Tulsa, is Your Best Life. So just Google her. She's amazing. So I called her, and she's the one I trusted with this. And she said she is such Lyme phobic. She was like, "Here's a 28-day prescription for antibiotics. Just take it. Don't worry about it. Deal with the consequences of the antibiotics later." And I was like, okay. That went away, and I was fine. I haven't had a problem or symptom since. But I had this rash. Now, that rash only shows up 50 to 80% of the time. That means 20 to 50% of the people don't. And there's different statistics out there. Some people would say it's even less than that. But half the time, you don't even get a rash. So you may not see the tick. You may not get a rash. So what do you get? Well, you get, the stink, the crud.
Okay.
So you can have fever. You can have headaches. You can have joint pains, neck stiffness, heart palpitations. It's all these vague kind of things. So some people could think, I just have the flu, especially didn't get a rash, didn't see a tick. I have all these symptoms. I must have had the flu.
Sure.
Now, the difference is most of the cases of Lyme disease are usually, in the summer, because that's when people are out in the woods more. We get more tick bites and things like that. I mean, ticks aren't out when it's minus 20. So you're not going to get Lyme disease if it's minus 20 outside.
Of course.
So, those are some of the symptoms that you can get. So it's this very, very vague presentation in the acute phase, coupled with you may not have a known exposure. And certainly here in Oklahoma, I had a patient that went to see, I believe it was her rheumatologist, and she literally had every possible criteria, both clinically, meaning her symptoms, and her laboratory diagnosis. She had every one of them, 100% of them. And her rheumatologist looked at her and said, "Well, I know this looks like Lyme disease, but it can't be Lyme disease because we don't have Lyme disease in Oklahoma." My when she told me that story, my jaw hit the floor. You know, they didn't have Lyme disease in Lyme, Connecticut prior to 1974 or five, whenever they, you know, diagnosed it initially. Mm-hmm. You know, in theory, we didn't have it then. No one had identified it. So we as physicians need to be vigilant that just because we don't know it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And it's just maddening that we can be so dogmatic as to say, well, we don't have that here, so it can't be that. You know, you can get punched in the face and say, well, that guy's not mad at me, so it couldn't have been a fist in my face. I mean, give me a break. It's, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, you know, consider it maybe a duck. I'm just saying, you don't need to go to medical school to figure that one out.
So I maybe have one or none of these symptoms, and the next step is to go in and see my physician.
Yeah, and, you know, again, you got to be careful about what physician you see, because not everyone believes in this process. And some, you know, and you might go see your doctor and, you know, think, well, I may have been exposed. I may have these symptoms. It's very vague, might have some headaches and fever or something. And they may or may not treat you at all. And then they may give you this, like a 10-day course of antibiotics. Again, this is where it gets really, really tricky and really controversial, because there's a lot of controversy that says, you know, you treat for, you know, 2 weeks and that's sufficient. I can tell you from my experience that I don't believe that the number of patients that I've seen with Lyme disease are crazy. And, you know, where they took a round of antibiotics and it wasn't sufficient. And they went back and their doctor was like, well, I don't know what to do. Are they saying they're making it up? You know, it's, we readily prescribe, you know, like in our last podcast, we readily prescribe proton pump inhibitors for years and years and years, but we won't treat a patient with suspected Lyme disease for more than 2 weeks. I mean, it just doesn't make sense to me. We're not consistent with this as you know, thematically, where we minimize our medical treatment, and we, I would argue we over-treat some patients and way, way, way under-treat some patients. And I think many Lyme disease patients fall in this category. So, you know, we spent most of that time talking about acute Lyme disease, but then you can also have this chronic Lyme disease, which is also known as a post-Lyme syndrome. And there's, again, a lot of controversy about this stuff. And a lot of it has to do with the diagnosis. And how do we diagnose true Lyme disease, and have you been exposed? And so I think the next thing to do is to go through, you know, preventing Lyme disease and the testing of Lyme disease. And I think it'd be a good thing to do after the break. Vertical Limit Fitness constantly strives for better mind, function, fitness, capacity, and community. They accomplish this through bodyweight boot camp style classes and high intensity functional fitness classes. From group classes to private training, Vertical Limit Fitness elevates your health and wellness while helping you become able to do anything and prepare you for everything that life may bring along. Call 918-409-1633 or visit their website at www.verticallimitfitness.com for more information and to sign up for a week of classes.
All right, and we are back. We're talking about Lyme disease, and the identification and the testing of it is grounds for some controversy. So, Dr. Edwards, begin getting us into how a lot of different clinics and hospitals, they'll actually test for this and why it's a big deal.
Yeah, that, and it certainly is a big deal. And I remember when I first started looking at and testing for Lyme disease, I had a patient that came to me that wanted a test by Igenix. A lot of controversy with Igenix, but they wanted this lab test, and I was like, I'll get it, but I don't know that I know how to interpret it. And so I tried to be as candid with them as I could. And the interesting thing to me is so many physicians will refuse, and they'll say, I'm not going to get that test. It's hogwash. Well, what do you care? The patient's asking for it. They're willing to pay for it. It's not an insurance deal. What do you care? I mean, it's offensive. Quit being so freaking high-horsed about it. I mean, it's really maddening, and it really irritates a lot of patients, and I don't understand it. But regardless, so this patient came in. I didn't know how to interpret the test, but the patient's saying, hey, I want this thing, and I was like, well, all right. I don't know that I can help you with it, but here you go. Now, I try to educate them, you know, because we're supposed to know more of this about this than the patient does. So got this test. We'll talk about what it means in a minute. But, you know, your standard physician, they are going to, if the patient goes to, before I started doing functional medicine, patient came to me and said, I think I got Lyme disease. Then I'm going to say, okay, let's go ahead and get some blood tests and we're going to check antibodies. And this is established by most insurance companies. And it came about, this diagnostic criteria came about because of epidemiologic data by the CDC. So the Centers of Disease Control set out, here's the criteria that we're going to use to follow who has Lyme disease. And it's an ELISA test or an antibody test, serum, blood, antibody test. And if that is positive, then as a screening test, so screening tests are supposed to have a high level of sensitivity. Sensitivity means that we catch almost everybody that's got it, but it may catch, you know, some others as well. So it's not specific to Lyme disease, but we want to make sure we catch everybody. Then we do a specific test with the Western blot test, and that's a specific lab test where they, I think it's like a gel electrophoresis is probably the best way to describe it, and they put the proteins or the blood in these little wells and run electricity through it, and it migrates through this gel at certain rates depending on the size of the protein. And so we're looking for these certain kilodalton sizes of proteins, and then we look at these patterns, and they'll show up as bands in this gel. And then based on what we see, then we'll say that's a positive Western blot or not. If you don't have a positive antibody test, because again, that sensitive test is supposed to catch everybody, and then we do the more specific confirmation test. And that's exactly how we diagnose HIV. We use a sensitive antibody test, and then we confirm with a Western blot, because it's you may have a positive antibody test, but that doesn't mean you have the disease. You got to get the confirmation test, and since that's very specific to that disease, it'll say, oh, okay, this was a false positive test because you don't have this. That's how that Western blot's used. So the problem is that they have looked at studies where patients had culture positive. No, we draw your blood out. We culture it out, and the bacteria grows. So that can't happen unless you have the bacteria. Of the ones that grew, only 30 to 70%, wide range, 30 to 70% of those patients were antibody negative. They didn't have antibodies against the bacteria.
Wow.
So remember, a screening test is supposed to be very sensitive, supposed to catch everybody. 30% and certainly not 70%, that doesn't qualify as criteria as a screening test. It's ridiculous to use that as a screening test. And, you know, most doctors don't understand that. A lot of patients don't understand that. And so we'll get these antibody tests. And, you know, in the past, I would look at this and say, okay, well, your antibodies are negative, so you don't have Lyme disease. It's hooey. It's pure crap. That 80% of medical recommendations are crap. That's part of it. So if their antibodies are negative, they won't go on to do the Western blot. Now, the other thing about the Western blot test is there's two different antibodies that we're looking at. We're looking at an IgM Western blot and an IgG Western blot. We're looking at two different sections. And they're two different antibodies that your body makes. The IgM comes out faster after an immunologic exposure. In other words, you get any kind of antigen, whether it's the flu, bacteria, anything, and your immune system has to mount a response. IgM is the first one that comes out. Then you make these more specific through a series of immunologic components. You start making IgG antibodies, which are much more specific to that specific antigen. But the IgG process takes time. IgM is much quicker, doesn't stay in your system as long, and then you have the IgG that comes on. So we're looking at IgM and IgG on a Western blot. Now, the CDC criteria for this epidemiologic stuff says that you have to have two bands positive on your IgM or five bands positive on your IgG. If you don't have 2 and 5, and there's specific bands that they look at on that Western blot, which is those little bands that we talked about going through the gel, if you don't have that, then they say it's a negative test. Now, the interesting thing, and I talked with Dr. Christ, he's a Lyme disease expert out of Missouri, and I actually talked with him about this, and one of the things that he consistently says is if a patient has at least one of these specific bands, 97 out of 100 of those patients with one band positive get better on antibiotics. Now, that's not diagnostic. That doesn't mean that they had Lyme disease, and I think it's important to make that distinction. But they got better. Your patient came to you with a problem. You tested for something. You treated for the, you treated them for it, and they got better. Well, okay. That's at the end of the day, that's my job, right? To make that patient better.
Sure.
Not to sit there and argue with them about, well, this is or is not this diagnosis. Now, I'm not an advocate of willy-nilly throwing out antibiotics. Any question, look at, you know, listen to the upper respiratory antibiotic podcast that was, I think, number 12 or something like that. So I'm not a fan of just willy-nilly giving antibiotics, and they certainly have risks. But chronic Lyme disease, these patients with these kinds of problems are already feel awful. They're sick. They've got issues. And if I look at them and say, this is not Lyme disease, I have no option for you. Well, what good am I doing there? And again, I don't want to overdiagnose Lyme disease, but I've seen it so frequently and we've treated them and they've gotten better, just like Dr. Christ said. That doesn't mean that they're quote cured. We haven't resolved all their issues, but they got better. They improved. So we still need to work to try and get them back to optimal health. But looking at these tests, you've got to, and the other thing is the standard labs that I used in the past wouldn't report the actual bands. They just said Western blot positive, Western blot negative. All on that criteria that was set by the CDC that was never intended to be diagnostic criteria. So I didn't have the opportunity to make a decision myself based on the actual data. Somebody else was interpreting this for me. So one of the reasons that I like Igenix is because I get the actual data and then I can make a decision based on their clinical information. And one of the interesting things is, you know, when we look at someone that has been exposed to Lyme disease or we're concerned about Lyme disease, the diagnosis is, by criteria, is clinical. And one of the statements that I read, serologic testing can be used to support a clinically suspected case, but is not diagnostic by itself. So you don't want to take a patient that feels 100% great, get testing, and they've got it, and then you say, well, you've got Lyme disease, but they're 100% perfect. Well, that it's a clinical picture confirmed by laboratory data. And we have to be careful about how we interpret that data.
Not the other way around.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
So the testing, you know, it sounds like, you know, the quality of the testing or the way that it's interpreted is a little bit up in the air. You know, it's
right.
Maybe the way that it's done or the way that the doctors are interpreting it is potentially because they don't know a lot about it. Now, you're a very learned professional, Dr. Edwards, but you didn't know when you had your first patients coming to you with Lyme disease. You had to go learn about it.
That's
maybe,
right.
Maybe it's not a hot topic in medical school that you're learning about. It's not
right.
One of the first things that you're learning
right.
There.
Sure.
So it's upon the doctor to educate themselves on these types of things in these topics that you're bringing up.
Right.
Now, for all the listeners, what are some of the things that they can do? Okay. What are the ways to have that conversation with their doctor? Hey, maybe this isn't going about the right way. Maybe I want another test. What should they be asking?
Sure. So I think, you know, you're going to get a lot of kickback if you go to your doctor and say, I want an Igenix Lyme disease test. I can almost guarantee you're going to get a lot of kickback. For one, the doctor has to have an account with that lab if the doctor is going to order it. Sometimes a patient will, some labs will just accept a physician order, but they kind of set the account with the patient. Sometimes that occurs, but you know, if you're in a large organization, you may not have the liberty to create an account with that lab. And there are several specialty lab testing companies that you have to create an account like that. So they may not be at liberty to do that. Then they may not agree with it. And there are some studies that will suggest that some of these specialized Lyme disease testing is no better than, you know, the others. And you have to look at the data behind that. And what questions were they asking? What was the patient population? And again, you're talking about something that's very controversial to begin with. So your patient selection to say that, yes, this is Lyme disease or no, it's not. I mean, it's like it's two gray things that you're trying to evaluate and saying, this one's more gray than that one, so that doesn't work. I mean, it's a very, very gray. There's not a black and white answer to this. There's not. And I don't think any physician, you know, can say that it is a black and white issue, especially when you take something like that patient that I mentioned earlier that had every criteria possible. And a rheumatologist told her that because it's not in Oklahoma, that it can't be Lyme disease. And there are confirmed cases of Lyme disease in Oklahoma. So it's, you know, the ticks don't stop at the Mason-Dixon line.
So in, you know, closing here and understanding it, patients, they should feel empowered to, you know, do some of this research.
Right.
And if nothing else, be able to go on to some of these studies and look up these different testing facilities that they can, you know, research, you know, where are these labs coming from, or what is the information behind these labs? How have they arrived at the quality of these labs in the past so that they can talk to their doctors about it?
Well, I think the lab offers a service, and they have to have a CLIA. Identification number. I forget the name or the what it stands for, but you have to be a, you know, a CLIA certified lab, and you have to have a number. So there's controls that are on that and those kinds of things in order to offer that kind of testing. And, you know, it's through that scientific process that the lab knows, you know, what they're doing. And there's a medical director, of course, with every lab. It's the way they present and interpret the data that, you know, some of the other tests, some of the other labs are not providing. And so if you don't like the way that lab was run through your lab, then ask the question. I mean, we're not talking about doing surgery. We're not talking about doing something that's of potential harm. We're talking about gathering information. So there's no harm in that. It's how you interpret that data that could be potentially harmful, or the way you apply that data, you know, to a therapy. So we're not talking about anything that can cause any harm. And the first dictum of medicine, of course, is first do no harm. So we're not talking about something that's going to mess somebody up. It's just don't refuse to try and help that patient, even if it's the way that they want to be helped. We have to get patient buy-in. We have to be on their side and on their team. And I think so often it's like the doctor versus the patient and the patient versus the doctor. We got to break that paradigm. Let's support the patient in the ways that aren't hurting them. If they come in and they say, I need, you know, 500 Lortab, you know, and hydrocodone and Percocet, well, okay, now I have to prevent them from harming themselves. But we're talking about collecting information. I just fail to see how that's harmful. So if your doctor isn't doing that, then seek out a functional medicine physician, or you can go to ILADS, ILADS. It's one of the societies on Lyme disease, and you can find an ILADS certified physician. I am not, but I've worked with Lyme disease a fair amount, and I'm open-minded to, you know, I just want these patients to get better. So however I can do that in a way that's not harmful, then let's do that.
So to all of the doctors, continue to have the patient at the forefront. And
right.
If all they're asking for is to be educated on what their symptoms are or the potential of having a disease, you should empower and enable them to be able to do that.
Right.
And for all the patients, if you're doctor or physician or family care practitioner is not giving you those things, there's groups like revolutionhealth.org that, you know, you can seek out.
You got it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Edwards.
Thanks, Marshall. Always appreciate you.
Bam.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast with Dr. Chad Edwards. Tune in next week where we'll be going against the grain.